Thank you, everybody, and I don't think I have to add any other words to Rick, except it's always an honor to share the podium with a good friend like Rick and to also be able to present a very distinguished panel such as the one that's here. I know that our colleague Julia Taff will make the formal introductions, but I wanted to thank you also because, I don't know, Rick, if you held up your book, I don't think you did, but the CSIS project on post-conflict, of which I was on the original team, has done some extraordinary work on measuring progress in Afghanistan, and it's very much worth a look when you finish this program because it's one of the few places where you can get some very good qualitative as well as quantitative data about it. You know, the United Nations Foundation is always pleased to co-host something when it has to do with a cause like the United States Committee for UNDP. And because I'm not on the board, I can say that this is an organization that all of you should take a look at to become members of, to support, because there is no more important time than the times we're living in to be able to support an organization that takes seriously the idea of security, development, and freedom that Secretary General Kofi Annan expressed in his document to the General Assembly. So I am very happy to be here. The UN Foundation is honored to support this event, but even more important, we are honored to be able to ask all of you to also be part of a very important movement in Washington. And with that, I think I'm supposed to introduce my colleague, Ken Wallach, who is going to start the conversation. Ken is the chair of the board of the U.S. Committee for UNDP, and in his day job, he is also the president of the National Democratic Institute, an institution for which we all know Ken and his dedicated work over the years in the support of democracy, and in particular, the support of electoralism, and in particular, the whole work that has been done in our own knowledge and deeper understanding of how to promote the best practices in good governance and electoral skills on the ground. Ken is going to report to you about the work that NDI did and more generally about the broader electoral process, but I don't need to say more words about Ken Wallach. He's a well-known individual in Washington, and it's an honor to introduce you.
Thank you, Brian. My mother thanks you, too. I'm just going to say a few words and to get on to the real meat of this program to hear Julia and Amira Hawk. But I just wanted to say a few words about Afghanistan and about the work of the United Nations from the perspective of one of the organizations that cooperated closely with the UN. As we all know, on September 18th, which is almost four decades after its last legislative poll, Afghanistan held elections for the National Assembly and provincial councils. Most observers agree that the elections held under extraordinarily difficult circumstances were a success, representing a positive step forward in Afghans' political development. Following an energetic campaign in which nearly 6,000 candidates participated, including over 550 women, Election Day was relatively peaceful and orderly. Although voter turnout was lower than the presidential election, over 6 million Afghans participated. Given the enormous complexity of the balloting, voting, and vote counting process, the administration of these elections was impressive. The United Nations Assistance Mission to Afghanistan, UNAMA, played a key role in the preparations for these landmark elections. It was careful, and I think in a sense most important, to leave a light footprint. Everything the United Nations did, I believe, was to build Afghan ownership in their own political and electoral processes. The UN provided crucial assistance to the electoral process, particularly in supporting the Joint Electoral Management Body, or the JEMB. And despite daunting operational challenges and a deteriorating security environment, the JEMB was able to hold polling in all but a handful of districts throughout the country. The UN also worked closely with other organizations working on the ground to support the political process. And I know how closely my organization, NDI, worked with UNAMA and the JEMB. From promoting cooperation between political parties and the JEMB throughout the country, to the training of candidates and party poll watchers, which reached over 70,000 Afghans at NDI's eight regional resource centers, to developing a code of conduct for the candidates and the political parties which lowered the level of violence and intimidation. We all know, however, that a successful election is not going to necessarily produce a legislature and that is accountable or effective. The Assembly, as we know, according to the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission, over half of the newly elected parliamentarians are suspected of having links to armed groups. None of the members have previous legislative experience, and many are non-literate. And despite pessimistic predictions about the fate of women in the elections, almost 30% of women candidates won seats without invoking the quota. Nevertheless, women representatives will encounter serious obstacles. After years of being barred from employment, education, and political life, many are unprepared to assume positions of leadership in the legislature. Reaching office through reserve seats, coupled with conservative social norms, may further erode the legitimacy of women struggling to establish themselves as qualified and equal members of the National Assembly. The United Nations' continued engagement in Afghanistan's political development, therefore, will be essential. In the same way that the UN-sponsored bond agreement in 2001 successfully set out the benchmarks for Afghans' political reconstruction, a UN-sponsored post-bond compact would help pave the way for the consolidation and expansion of the political gains made to date. Donor countries should take advantage of the opportunity presented by the proposed January 2006 conference in London to further engage the Afghan government in its efforts to rebuild this war-torn country and continue to build on the achievements that the UN and others have made in the last few years. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ken, for setting that important context and raising some of the current challenges. When you reminded us all about the Bonn conference in 2001, that was just 4 years ago. You know, if we look back where Afghanistan was 4 years ago, there were no leaders in Kabul at the time or in Afghanistan. It was not until January that actually the end of December, that Karzai and the first group went back in. And UNAMA and UNDP were responsible for raising money and implementing everything from flying in money to pay the civil service salaries to trying to get the buildings capacitated and sort of winterized so people could go back to work, getting vehicles, starting the planning for the emergency Loya Jirga, the Constitutional Commission. I can't believe how quickly what we're going to hear about today has come about when you take a long view of Afghanistan. And I want to say this because I was involved. This was my first crisis when I went to work for UNDP, and my deputy was Amira Haque. And she and I would look at each other and say, oh, my God, what are we going to do now? And we were so flexible and so innovative to be able to really write the roles that we could do for the UN and UNDP because there was nothing there to work with. Fortunately, Amira had served in Afghanistan in the past. She knew the lay of the land. She knew the culture. And she was, through the 3 years that she worked with me as my deputy at the Bureau for Crisis Prevention and Recovery, she was the one that prevented the crisis and helped me recover from the rest of them, and I'm very grateful for that. I think many of you have already seen the resume of a brief resume of Amira, but let me just summarize it by saying she's the top woman in Afghanistan. She is one of two deputy special representatives of the Secretary General. She wears many, many hats, but only has one very clever and brilliant head. She is the deputy SRSG for Relief, Recovery, and Reconstruction, which is the sort of development arm of the UN family there. She is the resident representative of UNDP. She is the humanitarian coordinator for all of the UN agencies out there. And she had a very strong role in the whole issue of the elections. When we found out that she was going to be coming to this part of the world to see her daughter, who is here, welcome, we decided to grab her because to get a first-hand view with the kind of historical perspective and the smarts that Amira has, we thought would be extremely useful. You'll see in her background, she also worked for UNIFEM, and although she's the first not to want to be the token woman dealing with token women issues, she knows about the empowerment of women. She knows how important it is to make sure that they do have a voice. And we're just so pleased to have you, Amira, joining with us. And please welcome her to give her insights, and then we'll have a chance to question her afterwards. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Julia. Actually, she was the one who was preventing all the crises. And I must say that in my career in UNDP, you know, Julia was talking about the times before, you know, just prior to the Karzai coming back in December 2001. And Julia came into UNDP at that time. And I think that, you know, the response of UNDP to the crisis in Afghanistan, which shaped, I think, the response of UNDP to a number of crises, was very much led by Julia. So I think UNDP owes her really a great debt of thanks for having positioned UNDP so well in this whole area of crisis prevention and recovery. Well, thank you very much, and thank you for giving me this opportunity today to speak to you a little bit about elections. As Julia said, I served in Afghanistan. I was in Afghanistan at the time that the Russians came in, and then I subsequently I went back in first of all in January 2002 to prepare for the Tokyo conference. And Julia is absolutely right. I think, you know, the country that I left in 1981 just did not exist. I mean, you know, there was absolutely nothing there. I mean, you know, we didn't even have enough beds in that place to sleep. And having gone back, I mean, I've been in Afghanistan now for a year and a half, and I think that you know, very often we are not able to appreciate, or sometimes we underestimate the amount that goes on in the immediate post-conflict situation. So I think a great deal has been done in Afghanistan over the past 4 years, but as I will tell you, there are you know, a lot of challenges and new challenges and unforeseen challenges that crop up. But clearly, I think the two elections, both the presidential and parliamentary, we can say have been deemed successful. I think successful because, you know, we were able to carry it out, and you know, they took part in all parts of the country really without any significant incident. Particularly the one that Ken just mentioned on September 18th, which was for the National Assembly and provincial councils. And if one looks at what the challenges are in Afghanistan, as he was saying, a number of the parliamentarians will be illiterate. So majority of the candidates were illiterate. You have, you know, great challenges in terms of the terrain and access to people and populations. You know, tremendous challenges in terms of infrastructure. So, you know, the fact that I think the entire international community was able to mobilize the way it did was something quite remarkable in terms of helping the Afghanistan people to carry out these elections. The there was a, with the Afghan independent, Ken mentioned this, the concept of light footprint. And when the United Nations mission went into Afghanistan, particularly having had the examples of Kosovo and East Timor, I think there was a concerted effort to keep the presence light and to try and shore up capacity. For those of you who are familiar, I think the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission has been just a very good example of just that. That, you know, the capacity of the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission is developing with strong leadership and you know, very bright and dynamic people there. During the election period, they were able to issue three reports that found out overall that Afghans were able to exercise their political rights with a, you know, sort of a pluralistic culture that was emerging. And, you know, one has to, I think, appreciate, in a sense, the courage that it takes for some of these reports and the findings to be published. But there again, I think with the participation of many organizations with the United Nations system, this kind of political rights reporting has become a key and a good feature. Ken also mentioned that you know, there were a large number of candidates, over 5,800, for the National Assembly elections. And as you know, the system of voting that that was selected was the single non-transferable vote. This, I think, to a certain extent, complicated the elections for the average Afghan. It was not, I think, a system that the international community particularly endorsed. I think there were a number of conversations that that the United Nations had also with the government in trying to you know, sort of elaborate what the pitfalls of such a system was. But clearly, the president at that point felt that the people of Afghanistan were not ready for the proportional representation system and not ready for political parties. The feeling being that if political parties were established right now in Afghanistan, they would tend to form along ethnic lines, that it was not yet at a stage where political parties could be formed along ideological lines. And this, I think, among other reasons, led to the adoption of the single non-transferable vote. The turnout in the presidential elections was, I think, really quite remarkable, about 63%. In the parliamentary election, it was a, you know, it was still good, but it was reduced from that of the presidential election. And some tended to view this as a sign that the Afghans were already, you know, tired of democracy. But in the registration, in the voter registration that took place prior to the parliamentary election, there were 1.7 million additional voters who registered. So clearly, there was an interest, but we feel that there was really quite a lot of misunderstanding, particularly with the SNTV system. That a number of voters, particularly in the urban areas, you know, in this large list, which was like a newspaper of candidates, saw a lot of bad faces and didn't understand why these bad faces were there. And so I think there were a number of other incidents, issues around that that caused a little bit of the reduced turnout. And I think people were confused. I know, for example, that in Badakhshan, I went there and, you know, we were talking with someone and they said, you know, why didn't you vote? And someone said, well, you know, I didn't see Karzai's picture on the ballot, and so I didn't vote. And so, you know, there was you know, not sufficient understanding of, you know, what this election was and why there were so many people in there. I think one of the unexpected elements of this election, and I think it has taken us a little bit by surprise, was the element of fraud. We just really did not, this was both during the electoral process and then during the counting period. Particularly, I think what surprised us in the UN in terms of the extent to which it happened was the fraud amongst the JEMB staff themselves. And this was during fraud on polling day itself, and during the transport of ballots, and then during counting. And as Ken said, a number of candidates, people had been trained as observers. And when I went to a number of the polling sites, there were really a large number of people standing against the wall. And, we went around to ask who they were. And for the most part, they were candidates' agents. So one would have felt that with this, many number of candidates' agents, that, would not have been subject to the fraud. Of course, I was only in Kabul during the election day. There are certain areas in the south and east and southeast where we didn't have as many observers. But I think the pressure on JEMB staff. I mean, in the end, it was was it their loyalty to the UN or the pressure and the intimidation that they felt from commanders and others. And so there have been instances of fraud within the staff. The other issue, which was that we are a little bit reluctant to really celebrate what we felt was the turnout of women voters in this round, because we also found out that particularly in the southeast and the southeast, there was quite a bit of proxy voting of for women on behalf of the entire families, and this was quite rampant. All this to say, I think, that it really further emphasizes the need that a number of us who are involved in elections have always talked about, and that is the need for supervision and international supervision of elections. And I think, there is just a great deal of awareness of that, but particularly from the lessons that we've learned in Afghanistan, I cannot but underscore the importance of that element of it. I think that the full potential of what international supervision and monitoring can do has not been realized in Afghanistan, some of it due to security considerations. But I think this is something that that we really must emphasize. Then, in this instance, as was already said, there are 5,800 candidates, and of course that means that there are a huge number of losers in this election, they have not been particularly, as the election results are coming out, we have witnessed a number of protests around the country. In front of our office almost on a daily basis now, either asking for a recount, claiming elements of fraud. And this is, again, where the system of the single non-transferable vote doesn't help any, because, a candidate who has 101 votes is able to obtain a seat, but the person who has 100 votes loses. And so I think difficulty. But overall, we think that the candidates will present kind of a diverse ethnic and political spectrum, and particularly some candidates like the Hazara group, Mohaqiq, they capitalized on this very well, and so they took this to their advantage, and the Hazara group have done quite well. There's been a large number of jihadi candidates who we really felt, would not have, secured a large number of seats, but they have, in fact, done quite well. They may have done well in some instances, just because, you know, voters really didn't know who to vote for, and they were a popular name, or that, you know, there was some in intimidation. But again, on the women, the as we said, you know, this has been really quite a remarkable, I think, very courageous of the women who even chose to run in the elections in the face of you know, all the social and political tide against them. And for instance, some of you may remember during the constitutional lawyer Jirga, there was one really remarkable woman called Malalai Joya, who spoke out in the constitutional lawyer Jirga, and whose life was really threatened at that time, because she said, you know, why do I see these same faces? You know, why are they here? And, you know, this is, you know, we want change in Afghanistan. And of course, her life was threatened. She was protected by the UN for a bit. Well, she ran in the elections from Farah, and you know, she won on her own steam. She was, you know, she ran second in the overall place. Now, we had thought that some of the women did very well, and some of us originally thought that that meant that the women would actually get places beyond their quota for women. But I understand it's going to be pretty close. I mean, in other words, if a woman wins, as Malalai Joya did, then she does fill one of the slots of the quota. So the women will you know, have a strong presence, but it will not be very much beyond the quota, which is a, you know, somewhat disappointing. But I think it is quite remarkable that women did so well in the actual voting. So, you know, the question then is, you know, what kind of parliament are we going to see? And I think, as Ken was describing, I mean, we are waiting to, I mean, it will be, I think, a parliament that will probably be not as reformist as we all hoped. But I think, you know, we will have to, there will have to be a great deal of work in terms of how the post-Bonn agenda, now that the Bonn agenda is complete with the parliamentary elections, what and how we shape the post-Bonn agenda in terms of working with the parliament to see that the delivery of services, the strengthening of institutions that have been set up, and that, you know, the benefits actually reach the people, and I think that part of it has to be the essence of this post-Bonn process. You know, the elections were just not about the political process. And particularly since this is, you know, the United States, States Committee for UNDP, which, by the way, I'm so happy to hear that has been formed, and thank you very much to both the people on the podium for their active interest, because you know, it's important, I think, for the public at large to understand a little bit more about UNDP. And we've spoken about the integrated mission, UNAMA, where I am. But in my hat as the resident representative of UNDP, I also want to mention that, you know, the elections don't just happen as part of a political process. There is a huge logistics, administration, and financial consideration that goes into it to make all that happen. And there, I think, UNDP's role has been absolutely critical. Both the voter registration program and then the actual conduct of the elections themselves resulted in raising some $347 million. Now, you know, that's no mean sum. I mean, you know, that is just tremendous amount of commitment I think, on behalf of a number of people to understand what this process is and to make that commitment. And I must mention there that the USAID was the largest contributor. They contributed $90 million off that. But the voter registration project, you know, created a voter registry and a very large civic education strategy to inform the public of what was happening. And then what is very important in UNDP's terms is to build the capacity of the electoral administrations. And just to I think highlight some of the what takes place with all this money in terms of the logistics and how that spreads throughout the country. This included, for example, setting up 35 offices, 5,000 polling sites, 26,000 polling stations, recruiting 5,100 national staff, 125,000 polling staff, having 25,000 police and security across the country, 1,100 trucks to deploy all the material and carry it back, 460 cars, and I also have 540 donkeys. But the logistics and the administration of this, as I said, particularly in the challenges of the terrain in Afghanistan, was quite some undertaking. And of course, all this was done by the UN family. And in addition to that, in the presidential election, there was out of country voting done in Iran and Pakistan. So these logistics are now sort of winding down. A number of these people there are all these assets which have to be managed. Now a number of these assets will be turned over to the provincial councils or to other projects and programs so that they can be used. But a number of donors were forthcoming, and this kind of logistics is something that I think we don't fully appreciate how much it takes for people to manage and make sure that it all works without a hitch. Now the results are being announced. 18 of the 34 provinces the results have already been certified. This is the month of Ramadan, and Eid will be probably on the 4th and 5th, and the remaining 16 will be announced after the Eid holiday. So we're a little bit behind schedule in terms of fully establishing the upper and the lower house. Out of the 26,000 polling stations that there were, 700 polling stations. In 700 polling stations, the ballot boxes were quarantined. In other words, they are not going to be counted. Now, that is 2.6%. So I think, in terms of, it's not desirable, but on the other hand, I think that it is not such a high level of fraud. The 2.6% is disqualified because of fraud. As I've said, the reactions to the results as they are coming out are a number of demonstrations, a number of calls for recount or for re-elections, and losing candidates are calling the process illegitimate and fraudulent, and this will go on. But on the other hand, the opposition has done fairly well, and particularly Mr. Kanuni and his people, Mohakek, others have done well. The Mishrano Jirga was originally schedule. District level elections were not held because there was a problem with demarcating the district lines, and this will fall on the parliament now to determine the and certify the districts. Therefore, the provincial councils, who were originally supposed to elect one member to the upper house, will now, the president signed a decree last week that the provincial councils will now elect two members to the upper house. One will be the permanent member of the upper house. Other will be a provisional member till such time as the district elections are held. And at the start of the provincial councils, we had thought, therefore, that the president would appoint 17 provincial councils, but now he will appoint 34. So that was a change, and you know, there was quite some back and forth, but that has been passed now. So we have now the situation where we're waiting for the final certification. It is likely that the provincial council, the first provincial council elections, will probably take place around the 12th to the 14th of November. Hopefully by the end of November, the upper house members will be announced, and then hopefully Parliament will convene around the 18th of, at least that's the planning right now, the 18th of December. As Ken mentioned, that you know, we have a significant meeting coming up with respect to Afghanistan in January, on the 30th and 31st of January, and this will outline what will be the post-Bonn Compact. We're calling it the Kabul agenda this time, because I think the emphasis must be on the national ownership, and clearly some of the elements that will emerge. This will be a little bit more complicated, because it's not as easy as saying, you know, write up a constitution, conduct the elections. Now it's going to be a little bit more complex, because it's all about state building and institution building, enhancing security, sector reform. But ultimately, I think it's about taking delivery to the people, and looking at you know, elements of governance and you know, the benefits of development reaching the people. And so I think, as I said in the beginning, while a number of gains have been made in the 4 years in Afghanistan, there are tremendous challenges that remain in terms of weak institutions, lack of capacity, the huge problem of narcotics in the country, and the impact that that has on destabilization of the very processes that we've spoken of. So I think the challenges remain huge, but on the other hand, I think the elections have shown that Afghans are determined, that they are participating in their country's progress, and the parliament, even though perhaps colorful, will be you know, the element of providing the civilian oversight of you know, and taking the country forward. So thank you very much.
Okay, well, Amira, thank you. I am not surprised at your incredible tour de force here. Lots of notes, lots of very interesting things. I just want to recall when you were discussing the logistics back in 2002 when we had the emergency Loya Jirga. We had the largest airlift the UN had ever funded and managed in the history of the UN over a short period of time, trying to get people from every one of these locations, thousands of locations, to Kabul and back again. And I don't think we used donkeys. I know we used aircraft. But the funny thing, and I've got to find out about this tent, is, remember the tent? We went and got, we had to buy a tent. So we asked a GTZ to go and buy a tent that would be big enough for all of these convention people at the emergency Loya Jirga. And they found one. And it was absolutely immense. only after the fact did we realize that this was one of the Oktoberfest beer tents that had come from Munich and was being used by these wonderful Muslims for their big election. Now, I want to find out, first of all, is that tent still being used?
It is still there. It is still used for good purposes. But a lot of the conventions and meetings of provincial governors and it's still there. And, you know, when I first went to Afghanistan, Julia sent me a note, and she said, we're looking. I guess you're going to have some kind of meeting in Iraq, and she said, you know, it would be very symbolic if that tent could move from Afghanistan to Iraq. And I kind of raised it with the government, and I said, you know, would you be willing to? And it was no. You know, that has become an institution, but it really is the only sort of, in a sense, a convention facility that there is. And in fact, there was thought of having the first session of Parliament convene there if the new Parliament building was not ready.
Sorry for that diversion, but I did have to ask that question. We have about 15 minutes for questions and answers, so don't be shy. Please, May, would you like to begin? And introduce yourself, please, so that she'll know who you are.
I'm May Rihani with AED, the Academy for Educational Development. Let me first thank you for this very informative presentation and very insightful. It helps us all understand better the reality in Afghanistan. Amira, you mentioned several times, and Julia too, and all three speakers, that women were courageous in running for elections, that we had a good number, over 500, running for elections, that when the voting took place, a good percentage of women voted, and so on. I'm interested in knowing more about the Ministry of Women's Affairs, and how do you see it playing a role, not just now, but if you can project like 2 years down the line, what would be the role of the Ministry of Women's Affairs and how it can impact other ministries? Thank you.
I'm just, for those of you who are interested, I just had, it's a collection of photographs that are, collected. So you can just, shall I answer one or should we take a series of questions?
I think this is, for those of us who are women, we want to hear this answer.
Okay. All right. The Ministry of Women's Affairs, and for those of you, I know Masuda Jalal has been to the United States and Washington, and some of you may have an opportunity to have met her. She, as you know, was one of the presidential candidates, and she, even in the emergency lawyer Jirga, she was the one who got the second most votes next to Karzai. So she is really quite a dynamic woman. The Ministry of Women's Affairs now has established throughout the country the departments of women's affairs in most of the provinces. They have been very active in educating women and sensitizing women to the electoral process. And, she herself has been really very good in meeting with candidates and in encouraging women's participation. So I think the ministry has done very well in terms of the political participation of women. But again, as I said, part of the challenge, I think, really is how do we get more into the larger institution building and looking at, how can women, become more productive members of society? What can they do in terms of, there are small microcredit programs, training programs, but there's still, I think, a great deal to be done. And as I said, those women who did run, we talk about courage in very many different ways, but I think the courage of these women to stand up, particularly the ones in the South, You know, I remember just, I guess, you know, within the room, I can say that I remember a meeting that we had with the president, because we have these security meetings related to the elections. So I raised with him the issue that, you know, there were certain areas, voter registration sites in the South that we were not able to open because of security reasons. And, you know, that the people in those, it was in Zabul and some of the other areas, were just not allowing these centers to be open. And he told me, he said, you know, madam, I understand your concern. But, you know, let me tell you that, you know, the fact that, you know, anything is happening in these provinces is almost, you know, you have to look at it almost like a miracle. And he told me how entrenched, you know, and once one understands the culture and the tribalism in some of those provinces, it is very difficult. So the fact that some women actually ran in those provinces is, you know, in the face of death threats and injuries to them and to their families, etc., was really quite remarkable. So the Ministry of Women's Affairs, I think, is doing well. I think they need a lot of support, and they are getting a lot of support from a number of people. But I think they did very well in terms of the political participation. I mean, Ken might want to say something. Do you want to say a little bit more through the work?
Support greatly along with the UN, but I think a lot of work is going to have to be done within the National Assembly, because it's going to be a very intimidating setting for women with their male counterparts. And so there's going to be, in terms of establishing a women's caucus, everything from speaking skills to reaching out, all these issues are going to be so important. So there's a support network for them, so they feel that they can come around. It's not only coming together around women's issues, it's also coming around on national issues as well that may not be particular to women. But they're going to need a lot of support in the Assembly to become a voice. And so I think that's something the UN is looking at, we are certainly looking at to do.
Yes, please.
John Blackton from Strategic Advisory Services. As an old Afghan hand, I'd like to ask you a question about the new challenges that's cast in terms of the old ones. In the 30 years before the Russian invasion and before the civil war in Afghanistan, Afghanistan was the most aid-dependent country in the world and one of the three most, and its GNP was one of the three most narcotics-dependent. Now, once again, Afghanistan is the most aid-dependent country in the world and is the most narcotics-dependent economy. What are the chances that, unlike earlier political times in Afghanistan, the new institutions can actually promote accountability and break the traditional cycle of rent-seeking and corruption, which really has dominated 20th century political life in Afghanistan?
I think you're absolutely right that Afghanistan is one of the most aid-dependent countries, and Poppy, as yes, there it is, right there. Gorgeous. Yeah, beautiful pictures. Yeah, but Poppy contributes 63% of the GNP, as you know, and you know, when I was saying that, you know, some of it has, you know, in terms of, you know, within the 4 years, how quickly that has developed. And it has developed to a point now where it has become even more sophisticated, because it is now within Afghanistan. Earlier this didn't happen, but now within Afghanistan, as you know, it is being converted into heroin. And So this is, as I said, is probably one of the main factors in terms of, you know, when one looks at it in terms of any, you know, the major, I would say, destabilizing factor. For example, we have programs of demobilizing the soldiers from the illegal militia. Well, on the one hand, while those soldiers are being demobilized and reintegrated, the new drug lords now are importing arms and, you know, developing their own militia. In terms of aid dependency, Afghanistan's annual budget right now is about close to $4 billion. Dollars. The government of Afghanistan raises through its own domestic revenue only $333 million. It raises, and that is only half of its wage bill. You know, the entire wage bill, the government's operating costs, which is its wage bill and its operating costs, are about $680 million. Afghanistan domestic resources raises only half of that. The entire rest of it comes from external sources. But they can raise much more. I mean, there is more money to be raised in that country, but there are tremendous leakages in customs reforms. It's the, you know, of course, now Ismail Khan is no longer there, but it's the warlords who capture the customs revenues and other revenues within the provinces and don't turn it into the center. So in a sense, you've got a weak central government that is not able to capture the resources from its provinces and therefore has little power because there's nothing that they in turn are giving to the provinces to say, you know, I'm going to give you this in turn, you know, this is what we want you to do. You've got a security sector, the entire army and the police now, that are funded externally. They're not part of the domestic budget. Yes, I mean, I think these are some of the issues that have to, you know, that the international community has to sit and grapple with. And I think one of the keys is that, you know, there has to be some understanding within the community that, you know, a certain level of international financial commitment to Afghanistan has got to remain. And because, of, as I said, the country is not in a position to raise its revenue, also a drastic eradication of poppy is not the answer, and I think a number of people don't understand that, and that is absolutely not the answer, and it has to be a gradual, you know, alternative livelihoods and other things, you know, the sort of the entire package of interdiction, you know, good judiciary and, you know, stemming corruption and all these things, you know, will take time. So you can't wipe out two-thirds of the GDP right away. So these are, you know, I don't have the answers, but we know that these are the looming issues that we are, you know, talking about, which the post-bond compact will have to address. But I think it's the commitment. And I saw an editorial in the New York Times, I think it was 2 or 3 days ago, which said just that, that, you know, the commitment, and, you know, whether it's Congress or whether it's parliaments in Europe or others, and the presence of the international forces in building up the Afghan security sector, but this is it's a long-term process, and it has to stay the course. Otherwise, I think there are tremendous risky destabilizing factors, and you go back to, as exactly as you said, you know, we would go back, you know, to that same vicious circle.
May I just take the prerogative of whatever I am, the seat or something, to ask a point of clarification. When we were dealing with the initial donor support for Afghanistan, Ashraf Ghani, who's been here many times, and Karzai were pleading that donors funnel those resources through the government, not through NGOs or bilateral programs, for the very purpose of trying to have some access to funding so that they could provide services and get credit for services in these other parts of the country, rather than Danish Aid or CETA or USAID getting the credit, the government would get the credit. How much of what's going into the support for Afghanistan actually does get funneled through the government, where they then can be responsible for and get credit for delivery?
I can give you the exact figure. 13% goes through the government, and the rest goes outside the government budget. And that 13% is largely the ARTF, the Afghan Reconstruction Trust Fund, the Law and Order Trust Fund, which you all know. Those were all set up by this lady here, so she knows them only too well. But, you know, there is a reason, I think. And, I was just in London for a G8 pre-meeting to the post-bond process. And I think it is highly unlikely that donors will change their pattern. You've talked about corruption, and corruption is rife. There is no capacity. I mean, you know, we do not have, for example, the Ministry of Finance has what they call mustafiats, which means those are the representatives of the Ministry of Finance at the different levels. Well, just the police salaries that we're paying through that, you know, we've done spot checks. And 4 years later, there are still a large number of ghost police, you know, who are there. The systems, you know, just have not been set up. The capacity is not there. You know, people from Kabul are not willing to go outside of the capital to take provincial-level jobs. Those who are have no places to live. You know, the provincial capitals have no government housing or whatever. So, you know, there are just a lot of problems yet, I think, in terms of administration and, as I said, logistics and other things to say that a donor would have a certain level of comfort saying, okay, I'm going to give it to you as the government, and then you distribute it. But having said that, there is now a national budget framework. There are national priority programs, and the government signs off on where the money goes. So even though the money doesn't actually pass through the central treasury, the government nevertheless has a say in, you know, the money is going to go for the National Solidarity Program, or the money is going to go for immunization of, you know, children in this region or something. So the government is sitting down and setting priorities. Let me just throw one more thing into the equation here, and that is a lot of money which is now going through these provincial reconstruction teams, which the government has no say about and doesn't, you know, become part of a whole aid coordination mechanism. And we have been having a lot of discussions, both with ISAF and with the coalition forces, to say that that really needs to become part of the you know, overall aid management process. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Toby Berkman. I'm from the Henry L. Stimson Center. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about the role of ISAF and the OEF in providing security for elections and how you would rate cooperation with the UN in that regard.
You know, I should probably say that the elections could not have taken place without the presence of both ISAF and the coalition. And I think, you know, Julia comes from a larger humanitarian, you know, I mean, the longer-term humanitarian background than perhaps I do. But you know that there have been a lot of, you know, principles of civil-military engagement that has been enshrined over a long period of time. And I must say that in the year and a half that I have been in Afghanistan, I have come to realize that, you know, the world has changed, and that we just would not be able to do much of what we're doing in Afghanistan. And therefore, I would probably say, as I said, you know, the elections could not have taken place in the way that they did if there was not this collaboration. And I think that that collaboration probably, in my mind, was exemplary of civil-military relations. There was a, it was called a strategic security group that met every week. It had the Ministry of Interior, the Ministry of Defense, the National Security Council, the United Nations, Coalition, and ISAF. And they met every single week, and they meet, and they've continued to meet every single week. And it brings up-to-date information on all security elements. And if you do not have the information that ISAF has or Coalition has or the National Security or the National Intelligence Agency and what the UN has, and it all comes together in this weekly meeting in terms of saying how we are able to secure the areas, or they helped, for example, in the transportation of ballot boxes. There were areas that we could not go to. But let me just tell you an interesting kind of side. Between the presidential election and the parliamentary elections, there was a period of about 8 months, longer, but what was established was an emergency operating center, and this was set up within the UN premises. And we had real-time information coming in from every single province and district in terms of what was happening where there was some incident or some weakness that we needed to know about, and therefore we could respond to it. In between the two elections, there was should we dismantle all this or should we just keep it? And we actually were able to use it very effectively for the last winter and for the floods that happened. And those same, those computers and everything, that room was sort of like a command center. But every day, we had people from the Department of Disaster Preparedness who were sitting there, and they were the ones who were operating this. And every morning, the provincial governors called in and let us know what was happening with the floods and what was happening with, in winter, where populations were stranded or whatever. And again, we were able to use the air assets of the military to provide, the assistance. So this, as I said, for a number of people who work from the humanitarian community, I think it defies, as I said, some of the theology. But I think the world has changed. And so particularly for elections, I think it was a very good example.
My remarks on one issue, and as Chairman of the U.S. Committee for the UNDP. Amira has talked about how the world has changed, and everyone talks about economic globalization, but there is also political globalization as well. And I think the UNDP in particular, and the work that you've seen Amira and others do within the UNDP, has been extraordinary in helping, I think, the development community worldwide to understand the interconnectedness between political and economic reform. It's an enormous challenge, but there was a time where we thought simply economic aid could produce the stability and peaceful political competition, and we found out that while there are economic consequences to the aid, the problems are inherently political. And the UNDP has done an extraordinary job, not only in the writings and the human development reports, but on the ground and helping to work with other organizations, helping to coordinate, helping to carry out programs that bring these two communities together. The challenge, I think, is how to make democracy work and deliver. And it's an enormous challenge. But the work that the UNDP has done in this area, I think, has contributed measurably to the understanding and the work in terms of bringing these two issues together. So I just wanted to say that.
Well, that was a wonderful ending note. I want to thank CSIS and the UN Foundation and Elizabeth Latham, who's the executive director of our U.S. Committee for UNDP, for organizing this event. Ken, thank you very much for being with us and your leadership in it. I think it's really an honor to have you here, Amira, to not only speak with us but to help us figure out what is going on over there. And when you talk about brave Afghan women, let me tell you, you are one hell of a brave Bangladeshi woman. You are taking these people on there. The only thing I would suggest is that the kind of explanation and depth and understanding that you shared with us here, I do wish the people of Afghanistan knew all the effort that their government and their partners are making on their behalf. And we didn't have time to get into that whole communication standpoint. But if they only knew the measure of international solidarity, the hope, the effort that is being made by them throughout their country, please let's see if we can't maybe make that another initiative, UN Foundation, maybe there's something that you could help with too. But anyway, thank you very much for being with us and for all of you for joining us. Please give our speakers a round of applause.